Hello and welcome to Anne Boleyn's 1535 Reformation Progress, episode 3, brought to you by Sarah Morris from the Tudor Travel Guide and me, Vanessa Cain-Tate from Secret London Runs. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Vanessa. So good to be back with you for this third podcast. I'm so looking forward to picking up the adventure.
Oh, me too. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing really well, thank you. But what's going on with you? I'm curious to know what you've been up to, how you're doing since I last spoke to you.
Well, today is actually quite a big podcast recording day. I'm probably going to do about 4 hours of podcast recording.
Wow.
So this is my first session. And Josh and I are recording two podcasts this evening about the Rivals. So this is the first journey of Mary, Queen of Scots, when she was the infant queen. And it's the last little bit of her journey through Scotland before she left for France. So lots of rough wooing Josh and I will be doing tonight.
I love a bit of rough wooing.
It's such a good name, but masks such a terrible time.
Yeah, yeah. But such an interesting story. I love Mary, Queen of Scots' story, particularly the early years. But I mean, it's all so dramatic. I'm looking forward to that.
Dramatic. I'm surprised. I know she does get quite a lot of airing. I'm surprised there's not more, because every bit of her life, it's just so dramatic, so dangerous.
Yeah.
And I've absolutely loved doing. So I'm doing three journeys of her. One of them is her first journey. In Scotland, well, her first few journeys of life in Scotland as an infant queen. And then the second one is in France, so just after the death of her father-in-law, Henry II. And then the last one is her when she's active in England. So Mary, Queen of Scots, one journey in Scotland, one in France, and one in England. Today, we're finishing off Scotland. But let's get back to this journey, because this is an amazing, long and fascinating journey. So this is episode 3, and I believe that we are in Gloucester with Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. Is that right?
We are. So if our listeners remember, we had been at Tewkesbury at the Abbey, and we'd just been there for a short period of time. And then Henry and Anne carried on their journey, carried on heading south. They were originally heading towards Bristol. We'll hear more about that in the next podcast. But yes, the next stop on the agenda was actually in Gloucester. Gloucester, of course, was a gorgeous medieval city. Now, I might get into trouble for saying this, because this does sometimes happen, but unfortunately, it's not quite as gorgeous today, with the exception of the cathedral. Unfortunately, the 1950s and 60s town planners at some point got their hands on medieval Gloucester, and it's not quite as beautiful perhaps as we might like it to be, but you still have an amazing story. There's an amazing story, Vanessa, about the progress at Gloucester.
Amazing. Well, let's kick off that story. What happened when they arrived at Gloucester?
Now, what I want to, yes, I'm going to tell you all about this, because it's really, it's interesting and it's revealing. And the reason we know is because during Natalie and I's research for In the Footsteps, we came across this set of documents that were part of the Corporation of Gloucester records. So this would have been the records that the actual town of Gloucester themselves kept of the royal visit. And when we found it, I think it was in the Duke of Beaufort's papers, and it's a very little known document, and it was such a thrill to be able to write about it and bring it into kind of the sphere of awareness of Tudor lovers, because it gives us this amazingly detailed account of not only the ceremony, the pomp and ceremony that was associated with a royal arrival in any kind of major city or town, but also what the royal couple did while they were staying in Gloucester. We'll come to that in a moment.
What I'd like to know first, before we hear about what was in these records, is this idea of discovering something which is barely known. That idea to me, and I'm sure to our listeners, is really exciting. So how did you go about finding it, you know, sort of practically, where was it? How did you come across it?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit at this point, we didn't go physically delving into the archives of the Duke of mm-hmm. Beaufort, unfortunately. That would have been even more thrilling, I think. It was online, but it was just so hidden. You know, we did a lot of digging and then dig some more. I think that's what I learned about researching the book. You do your kind of first round of digging and certain things would come up. And sometimes you think you'd come to a dead end. And it was so easy at that point, or it could have been so easy just to stop looking. But I think from my experience, what I found is if you just kept digging, and we were really determined, that was one of the things that Natalie and I were so determined to find the exact lodgings in which Henry and Anne stayed. And very often that wasn't made evident. So if you read a lot of history books, you read about the events, but historians don't always isolate where these events took place or where the royal couple stayed. And we were really determined to track that down because ultimately we wanted to go and stand in the place, you know, to go and see the location. And we really came across some really interesting finds with regards to that. We managed to upset a couple of myths. We discounted one location, which has always been associated with Henry and Anne visiting. And we found no evidence that they ever went there, much to the chagrin, perhaps, of their kind of PR people. But we also were able to put things right. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about one of those actually in this podcast, where we were able to actually locate Henry and Anne the right place at the right time.
Amazing. I can definitely relate to that point that you made about historians don't mention actually where they were. And in doing these virtual events, I've got quite an interest in the exact point that people were at the exact times. And I must admit, my expectations of history have definitely gone down, as in what was recorded. It's definitely gone down, and I've realised that perhaps we are a little bit too demanding of history to document everything and for everything to have survived. So you've done an amazing job in actually tracking down those locations, because it's a lot harder than you might imagine, and who was there and what happened. And it, as you say, people say the events of what was happening at the time, and so many times I'm reading it and I think, but where was that? Where did this happen?
Exactly. I mean, with Gloucester, you might hear Henry and Anne visited Gloucester, but you're unlikely to have read, unless you read in the footsteps of Anne Boleyn, of course, you're unlikely to read exactly where they stayed. And that matters to lovers of Tudor history, because we want to go and touch the walls. We want to stand in that place. So it is important. So yeah, it was a huge thrill. I remember us finding it, and I remember just being so excited because I'd never read this level of detail before.
So what did you do? How did you celebrate?
Oh, I actually can't remember. I just remember just going, oh my gosh, you know, this is so exciting. Yeah, a lot of girly squealing probably, yes.
So we've got all this information from the Corporation of Gloucester about what happened when Anne and Henry got to Gloucester. So how were they received?
Yeah. So what would normally happen was that a delegation from the town or city would ride out. Let's say it's a city, because Gloucester was a city. So let's just stick with that for the time being. So a delegation, which usually involved the mayor and some of his brethren, you know, kind of the yeomen of the city, the wealthy citizens, would put on their best threads, and they would head out in procession through the north gates of the city, and they headed out to a place that was called the Green at the Heather End of the Lane, this side of Brickhampton's Bridge, and that's now a village called Down Hatherley. So we know exactly where Henry and Anne were greeted. And essentially, you know, the mayor and the other folk that had ridden there would all line up and they would shake hands. The right hand they even shook with the right hand. You know, it was very specific on how they were greeted. Wow. And there was usually a ceremony where the mayor would have carried the mace, because the mace, of course, is a symbol of power of the town. And they would have carried the mace with them, and they that there's usually a very fulsome speech, you know, aren't you amazing? You're such a fantastic king. Thank you so much for being so generous and bountiful and merciful. And we are not worthy. And we hope that you will continue to be good to us. It was that kind of a speech. And then the mayor would pass the mace to the king, who would ceremonially accept it before handing it back. And it was all ceremony. It was all about saying, thank you, this is my city. I'm accepting the power, but I'm now graciously giving that back to you. And then the whole process, the whole procession would reform, and they headed back into Gloucester. And we know that Henry and Anne arrived in Gloucester through the North Gate, which, by the way, is long gone, but it's next to the bus station, if anybody... Yeah, not very salubrious, I have to say. I did go and stand there and thought,
Not the most vibey place you've ever been.
Not the most vibey place at all. I thought, yeah, I know which I'd rather see here. But anyway, they went to the North Gate, and then within the gate, there was another delegation, again, waiting to meet them. This time, I think some of the religious brethren from the Abbey. And they were there with crosses, and the crosses were offered up to Henry and Anne, and they kissed them in turn. And then the whole the procession reformed, and they headed right the way through the centre of Gloucester before through the High Street, which you can still see today. The High Street is still there. Obviously, as I say, sadly, it's, you know, your typical shopping street of the 20th century. Yeah. You don't get the beautiful medieval.
You can see the Tesco Express that Henry and Anne would have galloped past.
Something like that. But not all is not lost, because they turned into St. Edward's Lane towards St. Edward's Gate, which was the entry point into the precinct of the Abbey. So any abbey was usually walled. It was like a little town in and of itself, usually with one or more entry gates. And St. Edward's Gate was the main entry point. And Henry and Anne entered into there, into the outer courtyard of the Abbey, where they finally dismounted. Now, the next bit, Vanessa, is one of my favourites, because there is a very clear description of them being greeted by the abbot of the then abbey, because we hadn't yet, of course, hit the dissolution. So abbeys were still abbeys. And he was Abbot Parker. And they'd arrange cushions on the ground, and Henry and Anne dismount from their horse, and they go into the porch of the abbey. And now, the reason I love this so much is that porch is still there. And it's
amazing.
Yeah, it's still there. And it's not a big porch. So you can stand in that space and know that you are literally standing or where they stood and where they knelt, because they did indeed kneel on the cushions. And again, the abbot presented the cross, which they kissed in turn. And then, as was the normal way, they proceeded inside the abbey church, and they would have heard, you know, they would have offered at the high altar and heard a mass and sung a Te Deum in celebration of the arrival of the king and queen. And that would have been the kind of normal procedure in which any king or queen would have been received into a major city. And it's all beautifully recorded there.
Wow. And what's Gloucester Abbey like now?
Oh, I love it. I mean, whilst a good deal of the medieval houses, of course, of Gloucester, as I said, have been lost, the abbey, although its claustral buildings, some of its claustral buildings were lost. Mm-hmm. The abbey church became a church for the town, so it was saved. It's a beautiful church, and it has some gorgeous monuments, including the tomb of Abbot Parker, who greeted Henry and Anne. So you can still see his tomb there. It's got some, the architecture is splendid, but the absolute highlight of Gloucester Abbey is its cloisters. Mm-hmm. It has the most beautiful cloisters I have ever seen. I think the finest in England. And in fact, many of your listeners listening to this who've ever watched a Harry Potter movie will have seen those cloisters stand in for part of Hogwarts.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And if you do go, make sure you look out for the lavatorium. Now, a lot of people think who don't know much about abbeys, you might be thinking lavatorium, lavatory, toilet. No, it's actually the place in which the monks washed their hands prior to going into the refectory to eat. And it's so beautifully preserved. Again, I've never seen anything like it. It is absolutely glorious. I cannot recommend it enough.
Wow. So add Gloucester to your list of places to visit, and the Abbey in particular.
Yeah.
So they knelt on the cushions and were... That was the ceremony, which sounds incredible. Do we know much about what happened to Henry and Anne whilst they were at Gloucester? Do we know how long they were there? What they got up to whilst they were there?
Well, unusually we do, and this is another, one of the highlights of these records. Henry and Anne stayed in Gloucester for 6 days. They arrived on the 31st of July, so height of summertime. We think that they were lodged in the abbot's lodgings adjacent to the abbey church. There's a little bit of confusion about that, because in the records there is a shortening that seems to suggest they stayed at the vineyard. Now, there was a country seat, a country house of the abbots of Gloucester to the west of Gloucester, sat on a hill overlooking the town, which was called the vineyard. And I thought originally that's where they'd stayed. But as I just did that, I was talking about digging. I came across a plan that had been reconstructed of the medieval abbey, and directly adjacent to the abbot's lodgings was a vineyard. And so I and it was labeled the vineyard. So I was like, okay. And then the other reason that made me think that they probably did stay in the abbot's lodgings adjacent to the abbey is, it's very clear from the Corporation of Gloucester records that every morning when they set out for the day, and we'll talk about this in a minute, they left from the yard outside the cathedral. And so if they were setting out from there, then that seems to suggest they must have been staying on site. Mm-hmm. So we don't absolutely know they stayed there, but I think they did.
That's incredible detective work.
It was so much fun. It was so much fun. But you asked about what they did. And, I think maybe sometimes, I think I thought this when I first started writing about progresses, that they were pretty much on the move all the time, but that wasn't really the case. They moved, but they would often, they'd move a couple of locations and then they'd stay at a location for 5 or 6 or 7 days. So they weren't moving every day. I mean, that would have been exhausting if you think about the logistics of all of that. And Gloucester was one of the places in which they decided to tarry a few days. And normally you don't get to really hear about what they did on those days in which they were staying in a location for any period of time. And you might ask why that is. Well, the two sources of information that are really helpful to locate a royal court are the letters and papers of Henry VIII, or whichever monarch you're talking about, because a lot of the letters will be signed and then dated, and the location in which the letter is written is recorded. So that's one way that you know. And the other way is to track down the privy purse expenses or the household expenses, because every day, I think it was probably the Lord Steward, there would be a record of what had been spent that day, and then it would be signed and the location was also recorded. So those are the two main ways in which we were able to follow the progress. But of course, once a court is static, then any business is conducted from that place and the household expenses are recorded from that place.
Right.
And you don't get to hear about what the royal couple actually do during the day. But because we've got these other records, we know.
And amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And although unfortunately, the Corporation of Gloucester records are incomplete, of the 7 days, we've only got 3 recorded days, it does give us an insight into what happened.
And so who was writing them? Can you remind me?
Yeah, well, it would have been like a herald or some kind of herald associated with the city of Gloucester itself. It's interesting because I've just been researching the progress of Henry VII to York in 1486. And the only reason we know anything about what happened on that progress is because of the herald that traveled with him. So heralds were responsible for, they were like observers. They were like a kind of modern day journalists, I suppose. They kind of tagged along and they kind of wrote an account of what happened and who saw what and what the main events were. And I think that's probably the kind of thing we're going to kind of, you know, the person that would have recorded these. I don't know for sure, but I'm imagining that's who recorded these accounts.
Amazing. And what did they tell us about what Henry and Anne did on those 3 days?
So the first day they headed off on to into the Cotswold countryside. We know that every morning they assembled in the yard outside the abbey, and quite often there was seems to have been some presentation. So I think on day one, you love this, Vanessa. This would be, you know, would this be your idea of a gift? Henry was given 10 fat oxen. Yeah, obviously good to feed the court, I guess, but he was given 10 fat oxen. On the second day, Anne was presented, I think it was with a purse of gold. So a little bit more, you know.
That's better.
More attractive. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they would gather and they obviously got the riding court together and then they headed out. And on day one, we know they headed over towards Painswick, which is a beautiful little village in the Cotswolds. Today it's called the Queen of the Cotswolds because it's so picturesque. Mm. And there's all sorts of a little bit of myth and rumour that along the way they stopped at a place called Prinash Abbey. It's actually spelt Prinknash, but it's pronounced Prinash. And interestingly, that abbey is still a monastery today. It's still a little Benedictine monastery.
Wow.
It's stuck on the side of this hillside overlooking Gloucester. It's a gorgeous Cotswold honey-coloured stone building. It's still a little monastery. And I wrote to the abbot of the monastery and said, did he have any record of Henry and Anne dropping in? Because that's what they did, Vanessa. They would head out for the day and they would kind of go to manors or lodges along the way, I presume, to stop for comfort breaks, to take refreshment, to transact a little bit of business. And the abbot of Gloucester owned Prinash Abbey. It was actually his retreat, his kind of one of his country retreats. So it would make a lot of sense that they maybe stopped in. And the abbot that I wrote to said, "Yeah, we don't have definitive proof, but we do. That is kind of the myth and legend that they did stop here."
It's a myth because it's been written about quite a bit that happened, but it wasn't in the Corporation of Gloucester's account.
No, that wasn't. No, I read about it that he said that they stayed there or they stopped there, but I couldn't find any definitive written account of that. But what we do have is that they carried on to Painswick, and we definitely have an account of Henry and Anne being at a building called the Lodge in Painswick, which was the main manor house of the village. And at the time, interestingly, it was jointly owned by John Dudley, who you might recognise the name. He, in time, would become the Duke of Northumberland. Of course, he was the father-in-law to Lady Jane Grey. And he jointly owned that with, I think it was Sir William Kingston, who had a lot to do with Painswick. In fact, Sir William would be buried in the church at Painswick. And again, anybody who knows anything about Anne will know that just 9 months later, William Kingston was Anne's jailer. He was Lieutenant of the Tower of London. So quite a turnaround in circumstances in a short period of time.
Yeah.
But there's records, there was business transacted at the lodge, and we know Henry and Anne were there because there is a letter, I think it was written by John Dudley after the visit, saying that the king had been there and he dealt with some trifling business. I think it was about woodland and who owned what. But it's those little letters that we managed. It's like they're like little breadcrumbs, Vanessa, that you can follow to keep hold of the trail. From Painswick,
so what else happened that day?
Yeah, well, they went off to a place called Missenden. Oh, by the way, the lodge is still there. Two of the four ranges still survive, and it's actually, I think, run as a bed and breakfast. It's only relatively opened as a B&B, so I think you can actually stay there. I never have yet because it's only relatively recently come about, but I think you can follow them on. I follow them on Instagram, so if anybody wants to look up the lodge at Painswick, you might be able to find them, and maybe you can go and stay.
That would be amazing, wouldn't it?
I think that is a candidate for a lovely weekend away in the Cotswolds, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely.
You'll have to get Josh to take you, Vanessa. The other thing we know that, again, a bit of myth and legend, but I'll throw it in there because it's all part of the story. There is a bit of woodland very close to the lodge, which is called Queen Anne's Wood or the Queen's Wood. And it's said that Anne hunted or hawked in the woodland. So again, there's a bit of myth and legend, but we do know they were there. We definitely know they were in Painswick. And then there's the record of them moving on to Painswick to Missenden. And there was a beautiful house at Missenden owned by Sir William Kingston. And no doubt the royal couple dropped in there. So we see them out and about. And this is what I absolutely loved about this account, because we hear that they come back to Gloucester at night. It's dark and they're received.
Wow.
I know, at dark. So they set off first thing in the morning and they're out riding, visiting these places all day, probably hunting and hawking along the way, transacting business, visiting people, being entertained by courtiers. And they come back to Gloucester, they arrive at the East Gate, and they are met by, I think it's a troop of sort of 15, I don't know what they were, but sort of, you know, the good and the great. And they had torches, and they conducted the king and the queen back through the city of Gloucester by torchlight. And
wow,
I think,
that's
yeah, and
amazing
if you,
image.
Isn't it? And if you think we're in the height of summer. So in England, it stays light till like 9, 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock, yeah.
So
gosh,
they're out
big
all,
days.
Yeah, they're out all day. And I can only imagine because they do a similar thing on the Tuesday, but they go in a different direction. So
where do they go on the second day?
On the second day, they head eastwards. And they appear to be heading towards a little village called Cobberley. And you can still visit Cobberley today. Interesting place, because if you do go, and you might have to get in the footsteps of Anne Boleyn to find exactly where you need to get to, but when you pull up, you can see that although the great manor house no longer exists at Cobberley, you can see architectural elements that tell you that something big was once here and significant. And the manor house is gone, but the church that was adjacent to the manor house and was probably used by visitors, Lord and Lady of the Manor, is still there. It's just an interesting little place. But what I really wanted to tell you about was on the way to Cobberley, it's likely that they stopped at a place called Brockworth Court. And we got to visit Brockworth Court. It was very interesting because one of the most fun things about writing this book was the chance to make contact with owners of amazing buildings and say, we're writing a book. One of the great things about writing in the footsteps is we got to get into all the nooks and crannies and email sort of owners of these amazing houses that are, essentially privately owned. But I found out that Brockworth Court, I think was part of, at the time, I'm not sure it still is now, but it did do very, very select tours occasionally. So I thought, oh, well, they might be open to me coming and having a look round. So I made contact with the then owners and they were very gracious and invited us along. And it's a beautiful Tudor house. It's absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous gardens, beautiful house. And welcome.
So it's pretty true to how it was in Anne Boleyn's time.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly the exterior, very, very true to that. And the owner took us upstairs and in one of the bedrooms, he talked to us about how there had been a painted emblem of Catherine of Aragon's on the wall. Now, this building originally was owned by Lantony Priory, which was another religious institution in Gloucester. And it was the prior's kind of country seat. And that was very common. You know, abbots were very important, high status individuals in Tudor society. And they owned property and they had wealth and they had status. And not only did they have their abbey or their priory, they often had a country seat as well, a kind of retreat. And this was the retreat for Lantony Priory. And she took us upstairs to the bedroom and he showed us this painted emblem and said that this was an emblem associated with Catherine of Aragon. And it had been painted over because it had been studied. It'd been studied by some experts and it apparently had been painted over. And so we couldn't help wondering if, you know, Henry and Anne had headed out there and they'd realized that the royal couple were coming and there was a suddenly panic stations.
You can imagine, can't you? Ah!
Quick, get the paint out.
Hey, brush. Yeah.
So, yeah, who knows? We don't know, but that's, you know, a definite possibility. But I talked to you earlier about debunking some myths, and I'm afraid this was one of those locations where I had to debunk a myth, and it was quite a tricky one to debunk, because the owner at some point, and I don't know where the story had come from, but you know how stories get corrupted.
Yeah.
The story was that Henry and Catherine of Aragon had visited Gloucester, and that Anne Boleyn, as his mistress, had been lodged at Brockworth Court. And I had to say, I'm really, really sorry, but Henry and Anne only came to Gloucester in 1535. That's definitively the truth. There's no doubt about that. And at that time, Anne was his wife. And that, therefore, I thought that this story had just become a bit corrupted over time. And that, yes, Anne probably was with Henry at Brockworth Court, but she was his wife and not his mistress. And I can tell you, it took some debunking. These myths tend to, once they've stuck, they really stick.
So did Catherine of Aragon and Henry ever go to Gloucester?
No, I don't believe they did, actually. I haven't studied Catherine of Aragon's progresses in the detail that I have Anne, but I've never come across the fact that Henry only came to Gloucester once. That's an absolute fact. So I'm,
right,
you know, sure that neither of them visited.
So do you think it's just a bit racier for her to have been there as a mistress than a wife? But that's how it's gone down.
That's exactly what I think has happened. Unfortunately, this owner had been telling countless visitors over the years that he'd been welcoming people that this was the story. And as I say, you know, we found this before. Once a story has got embedded in a place, it can be quite difficult to dismantle it. But I was on pretty sure ground on that day. So I don't know which story. If he's still there, I don't know whether he's still telling that story.
Yeah. So they went to Brockworth Court on the way to
Cobberley, a little village called Cobberley.
And do we know much about what happened at Brockworth Court or about Cobberley?
No, we don't really. It would have been much the same, you know, progressing from one place to another, staying for a period of time, riding on, probably doing some hunting and hawking along the way, probably returning late at night. And I think that's the rhythm. You know, if the weather was decent, I think that shows us what the kind of everyday rhythm of a typical day on progress would have been like. And in fact, I did write a blog called The Life of Anne Boleyn, When the Ordinary Feels Extraordinary, because to us, it feels extraordinary. But I think that's just what they did every day when they were on, or most days when they were on progress.
It sounds absolutely exhausting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they'd be moving quite regularly on progress with all of their furniture and tapestries and things. And then when they got to somewhere, it's not like they just chilled out and read a book. They were off still riding. Like they must have been so fit.
It was when I researched this that I came to that conclusion as well. I was like, wow. I mean, we know that the Tudors lived an outdoor life, but I never realized just how active they were and how fit they must have been.
Yeah. And so you said there were 3 days in the Gloucester records. Do we know anything about the third day?
It was the day of their departure. So we only hear about them leaving Gloucester and how they set out again, the whole train of the great and the good of Gloucester. And they progressed through the South Gate, heading south, not unsurprisingly, therefore. And they got to a place which today is called Quedgeley Green. And there's a lovely little pub restaurant called The Thatch. And again, here's another little rumour for you that Anne Boleyn stayed at The Thatch. I think if you find their website, you may well see that. Well, I don't think that's true at all, because they'd only just left Gloucester, but they might have been offered some refreshment. And it was certainly around this point that the mayor and his brethren sort of took their leave of the king and queen and the rest of the progress. The progress went on and their stay in Gloucester was over. And so they were heading southwards and they were heading towards Berkeley Castle. We know that on the way they stayed at a little priory in a village called Leonard Stanley. Again, you know, I have such fond memories of visiting because I'd never heard of Leonard Stanley and the fact that no. Anne Boleyn had stayed there. It's like a revelation.
Does that still exist?
Well, what exists is a tiny little village and a church which just outstrips the size of the village. And you see the church and you go, that's big for a parish church. And that's because it was a small priory. It was a cell from Gloucester Abbey. In fact, there were only three monks actually at the priory at the time of the visit. It was a small religious institution. And our research kind of unearthed that there was an adjacent manor house. And I suspect that that's where Henry and Anne stayed. But once again, if you do read in the footsteps, you'll read about how I was welcomed in by the owners of Leonard Stanley, and they showed me around the back and where the cloisters used to be and the architectural features and this fabulous little Saxon chapel, it was crumbling when I was there. And again, it is said that the prior of the priory received Anne and Henry in that chapel. And interestingly, since I was there and since I've written in the footsteps, that crumbling chapel has been completely renovated by a major grant, and it's now it's a place for weddings to take place. So,
lovely,
yeah, and actually, there are also holiday cottages on site. So again, you know, if you want to stay in a historic location, you can look that up, and you'll find those are available. So they only stayed overnight at Leonard Stanley. It wasn't a long stop. They were heading to Berkeley Castle, which was at the time it was owned by the Crown. So it hadn't always been owned by the Crown. In fact, for 900 years, with the exception of 60 years only, it was owned by the Berkeley family. But during the reign of Henry VII, Lord Berkeley had made a bargain with Henry VII that if he was to get the title of Earl Marshal of England and a bit of a promotion, greater status, then when he died, Henry VII could have his castle in return.
Wow. Not really caring about his children or anything, was he there?
No, you can imagine that might have sparked some interesting family discussions.
Really pleased you're an old dad, but
Exactly. So that's why when Henry and Anne arrived, it was actually in Crown ownership, and the couple would stay there again for another 6 days or so. Interestingly, every royal property had like a guardian or a steward that were acted in lieu of the king or queen. They were responsible for managing the upkeep of that property, and in return for their efforts, they could draw income from it. And in fact, the kind of guardian of Berkeley Castle was Thomas Cromwell, in fact, who was still with the Progress at that time. Yeah. So Thomas Cromwell pops
amazing.
Up.
So is Berkeley Castle still there? Can you visit it?
Oh, yes. It's very much still there. It's intact. So this is one of these locations.
Yeah.
So this is one of these locations you can actually go in and look around, and it's absolutely open to the public. It's an interesting castle. It was actually built by the Berkeley family, I think, begun in the 12th century, I think, and then with later additions over time. It's actually famous or infamous of being the place of the murder of Edward II in a very ignominious way. I might not want to talk about how, because it was not a very pleasant way in which they dispatched him. Dear listener, you might want to look that up for yourself. But yeah, so it's a typical castle. It's a single courtyard castle. All the privy apartments were built within the curtilage wall. There's a beautiful great hall. It's a gorgeous great hall. And I say this because I do reenactments at Berkeley Castle on a regular basis.
And it's how does that work?
Oh, well, I'm part of a reenactment group.
Of course you are.
Just dropping that into the conversation as we go. The Tudor Players, and we go about during the summer months and we go and visit certain places, and Berkeley Castle is one of them. And we are in all our beautiful finery. And in fact, often when we're at Berkeley, we do sort of stage were there, 1535, Anne Boleyn's visiting with Henry. And we have musicians and we do dancing in the Great Hall. And it's one of the best venues for the acoustics of the hall. And doing dancing is an amazing experience. So I do get a little taste.
Amazing. So what part do you play? Who are you?
Well, I certainly have played Anne Boleyn in the past because, of course, it's handy to have done all this research on her. Although I do feel I'm getting a little bit old for Anne Boleyn, and we have some youngsters coming through who are perhaps more appropriately aged to start to play some of those parts. But yeah,
so are you more of a noble woman now, or
yes,
yes, servants?
No, I'm definitely a noble woman. I have 4 gorgeous gowns that take up a large amount of space in my wardrobe, and I love putting on the bling. So I'm afraid, yeah, I'm just, I stick to being one of the member of the upper classes.
Are there servant vacancies available?
Yes. We don't have any servants actually, but we've often talked, it would be wonderful to have some people who are fulfilling that role as part of the kind of the overall court vibe going on. Yeah.
All right.
Are you going to apply, Vanessa?
No, I'm going to nominate Josh.
Excellent.
When we first set up Secret London Runs, I used to do quite a few murder mystery running challenges. So I had people dressed up in different places in London and they were all suspects in a historical murder. And people had to run up and say, where were you? And try and find out who had a motive, who had an alibi. And poor Josh always used to have to dress up as different people. It wasn't his top thing to do. Once, sorry, we're digressing now, but once, you can cut this out if you like. Once I was doing a Roman themed, because you know, London used to be a pretty Roman, Londinium, and Josh dressed up as a Roman toga wearer and he went to Leadenhall Market, which used to be the Basilica and the Forum in London. And he went there dressed in his toga and sandals and then he had to just stand there and wait for all these runners to come and question him. And he was one of the last places that people would go because he was furthest out. So he was there for about half an hour, just stood there looking a bit lost in his toga. Then all these people came. Apparently this builder came out and said to him, I'm so pleased that people started to come and talk to you and it was part of an organised thing because I just thought that you were absolutely mad.
Then, that is so good. That is so
good. Apparently on his way back to the pub where we were started, 2 sets of people started heckling him thinking he was on a walk of shame.
Poor Josh.
I'd love the coveted part of a servant in your ear.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Be really straightforward. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, what a great story.
But anyway, back to Berkeley Castle. What do we know what happened to Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII there?
Do you know, frustratingly, there are fantastic archives at Berkeley Castle, with the exception of the 60 years it was owned by the Crown. So... it's so frustrating. We don't really know much at all. There are a couple of letters written by Thomas Cromwell to his various contacts in London and beyond. But no, we know nothing of exactly what happened. But one of the things, apart from the fantastic Great Hall, which I do love, is although the interiors of Berkeley were renovated and remodeled, I think it was in the 19th century or early 20th century. So the furniture is not of the period, but the actual layout of the rooms is as it would have been during the visit of 1535. So you still have the privy apartments with the staircase going up from the Great Hall. You've got what was the chapel. It's now a morning room, but it's the footprint of the chapel is still there. And then you have the privy chamber that leads through to the bed chamber. And that would have been the flow of rooms. So I particularly like Berkeley because it allows you to experience the flow of a sort of a typical high status range. And that's what does survive. So that's what I take away from Berkeley.
Amazing. And they were there for 6 days.
Yeah, it was about 6 days. Yeah.
And then where did they go after that.
So they were due to go to Bristol, but as you will hear in the next podcast, they didn't make it as far as that because the plague had broken out in England and was particularly rife in Bristol, and the king wanted nothing to do with that. So instead, they continued south, but they truncated their journey and they stopped at the glorious Thornbury Castle, which will be the subject of our next podcast, in fact.
Thornbury Castle sounds amazing. Is there anything else we need to know before we get to Thornbury?
No, I think we've covered everything. By this time, I'm sort of imagining that the couple are well into the sort of swing of their progress. We're in mid-August by now. They've been away for 6 weeks or so. And I think as we start to go into this second phase of the progress, we start to get clues in the letters and papers of Henry VIII that all is going very well and the king and queen are very happy. And so we're going to pick up the second half of the story in our next podcast. Unfortunately, you're leaving us, Vanessa, but we are going to be joined again by the lovely Natalie, who's going to be continuing the journey in time with me then.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for such fabulous information and telling it in such a fun way. Thank you so much, Sarah. I've loved talking to you today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. As ever, it's been great fun, Vanessa. Thank you for joining me. And we will be returning together, I think, for the last podcast. So I'll be meeting you again in the very final leg of this journey.
I can't wait. Thanks so much, Sarah.
See you then.